voor de mensen die nog steeds op de magische driehoek, op de piramide rondrijden, een laatste oproep. Rijd u zo snel mogelijk naar Gorinchem. Van Gorinchem via de brug over de Waal richting Woudrichem.
Luisteraars, wij onderbreken dit programma voor enkele speciale berichten. In de omgeving van Werkendam is zojuist het ontzielde lichaam aangetroffen van een jonge vrouw. Het stoffelijk overschot vertoonde gruwelijke verminkingen, zoals afgesneden borsten, diverse diepe bijtwonden in hals en gezicht. De vermoedelijke doodsoorzaak is wurging. In de buurt van het lijk werden brokjes versnipperd borstweefsel aangetroffen, terwijl stukjes hersen her en der tegen de stenen en boomstammen kleefden. De mond van het slachtoffer zat volgepropt met menselijke uitwerpselen. Identificatie van het slachtoffer is door de aard van de verminking uitermate moeilijk. Op de toegetakelde romp was een afbeelding van een doodshoofd bevestigd. En ieder die inlichtingen kan verstrekken, wordt verzocht contact op te nemen met de politie in zijn of haar woonplaats. Dan is er nu nog een bericht uit Amsterdam. Even na 1 uur zijn in de hoofdstad 2 branden uitgebroken door nog onbekende oorzaak. Hierbij zijn in het totaal 6 kinderen om het leven gekomen. Op het moment dat de brand uitbrak, waren de ouders afwezig. Omwonenden verklaarden dat de ouders kort daarvoor met hun auto zijn vertrokken naar onbekende bestemming. Zojuist komt nog een nader bericht binnen uit Werkendam. Enkele meters verwijderd van het slachtoffer van de gruwelijke moord is het lijkje aangetroffen van een nog ongeboren kind. Door de duisternis was dit aanvankelijk over het hoofd gezien, maar een betrokkene bij het onderzoek struikelde erover. De man is met een shock in het ziekenhuis opgenomen.
De situatie dreigt enigszins uit de hand te lopen. Het is heel moeilijk om in stikdonkere nacht over smalle dijken te rijden. Daarom verzoek ik u bijzonder dringend, en ook jij daar in de auto die op dit moment naar mij luistert, om een gelijkmatige, rustige snelheid aan te houden. Als je naar aanleiding van deze gegevens, van deze instructies, begeeft naar het kleine dorpje Woudrichem aan de Waal. Als je Woudrichem binnenkomt door de poort van de koe, door de kerkstraat, langs de kerk gaat, sla dan rechtsaf de Hoogstraat in. Voorbij het oude stadhuis gaat de weg omhoog en kom je op een parkeerterrein. Daar parkeer je je auto. En dan begint het. Stap uit. Begeef je naar het kleine trapje naar beneden. Een trapje dat terechtkomt op een grindpad. Ongeveer 50 meter verderop, een klein bordje geeft het aan waar je naartoe moet, bevindt zich een kleine boot. En de veerman is klaar om jou over te brengen met zijn boot naar de andere kant, naar de overzijde. Naar een stikdonker gebied waar een kleine weg is. In de verte zul je een fakkel zien. Een brandende fakkel. Volg de weg naar de fakkel. Het is pikdonker. Het is een smalle weg. Ga niet van de weg af. Loop recht door. naar het licht van de fakkel in de verte. Voor jou thuis, die nog steeds bij de radio zit en die denkt dat hij het uit zijn luie stoel op zijn gemak zou kunnen volgen. Dat hij niet had hoeven meedoen omdat hij toch wel had kunnen horen wat er zou gaan gebeuren. Jij bent nu achtergebleven. Jij kunt nu niet uitstappen. En in de kleine boot van de veerman stappen. Om overgebracht te worden op die kleine zijarm van die grote drukbevaren rivier. Naar dat stuk land dat volkomen uitgestorven is. Waar geen huizen gebouwd zijn. Waar het doodstil is. En pikdonker. En waar fakkels de weg wijzen naar een ongelooflijk oord. Blijf jij maar rustig thuis. Neem jij zelf maar geen risico's. Luister jij maar rustig naar een gezellig plaatje.
When I live my dream, I'll take you with me, riding on a golden horse. We'll live within my castle, with people there to serve you, happy at the sound of your voice. Maybe I'll slay a dragon for you, or banish wicked giants from the land. But you will find that nothing in my dream can hurt you. We will only love each other as forever when I live my dream. When I live my dream, I'll forgive the things you told me and the empty man you left behind. It's a broken heart that dreams, it's a broken heart you left me. Only love can live in my dream. I'll wish and the thunderclouds will vanish. Wish and the storm will fade away. Wish again, and you will stand before me, while the sky will paint an overture and trees will play the rhythm of my dream. When I live my dream, please be there to meet me. Let me be the one to understand. When I live my dream, I'll forget the hurt you gave me. Then we can live in our new land. Till the day my dream cascades around me, I'm content to let you pass me by. Till that day, you'll run to many other men, but let them know it's just for now. Tell them that I've got a dream, and tell them you're the starring role. Tell them I'm a dreaming kind of guy, and I'm gonna make my dream. Don't
Luisteraars, wederom onderbreken wij deze uitzending voor een speciaal bericht uit Oudendijk. Even ten oosten van Oudendijk is opnieuw een stoffelijk overschot aangetroffen. Ditmaal betreft het een jonge man van ongeveer 24 jaar en ook hier is sprake van ernstige verminkingen. De maag was opengesneden, de geslachtsdelen ontbreken en de restanten vertonen tandafdrukken. De omgeving is afgezocht, maar de ontbrekende delen zijn nog niet gevonden, zodat het vermoeden bestaat dat hier sprake is van kannibalisme. Evenals bij het eerder genoemde misdrijf nabij Werkendam werd hier het doodshoofd aangetroffen, twee afbeeldingen ditmaal, bevestigd ter hoogte van de ogen van het slachtoffer, die echter, na verwijdering van de gruwelijke symbolen, bleken te ontbreken. Ze zijn nog niet gevonden. Wie inlichtingen kan verschaffen, wordt verzocht zich telefonisch in verbinding te stellen met een van de volgende nummers. 5 7 4 8 9 7 2 2 1 3 4 8 3 4 5 7 7 8 4 3 9 7 5 8. Like creatures of the wind.
Oh, with your kiss my life begins. Oh, spring to be, all things to be. Don't you know your life itself?
Ziezo. Hehe, ik ben blij dat het een beetje geregeld is nou allemaal, dat het allemaal voorbij is. Dat de meeste autorijders op weg zijn naar dat geheimzinnig punt. Ik geloof wel dat er nog wat achterblijvers zullen zijn, maar de meeste weten nu toch wel dat het op weg is naar Woudrichem. Wat vind jij daarvan?
Nou, ze vinden het wel. Er zullen nou toch geen mensen meer rijden daar op die piramide? Nou ja, als er nog achterblijvers zijn, bij Gorkum richting Woudrichem.
Ja, nou ja, u weet het wel, we hebben het nou zo ontzettend veel herhaald.
Nou, stom, hè, als ze het nou nog niet weten.
Ja, inderdaad. Ja. En ik bedoel, als je thuisgebleven bent, ja,
ja
dan...
Dit...
Kijk, ik bedoel, één ding is duidelijk. Dit is een programma met de kleinste luisterdichtheid die maar mogelijk is.
Midden in de nacht.
Midden in de nacht en alleen maar voor automobilisten.
Ja.
Ik bedoel, meer elite kan het niet. En dan nog, de eigenlijke sensatie komt pas als je uitgestapt bent en je op weg begeeft. Precies. En als je dus thuis bent gebleven, mis je dat allemaal.
Ja, maar die mensen weten niet dat wij ze gevoeddoet hebben. Hè? En als ze toch geluisterd hebben, er zit iets ingebouwd.
Daar wil ik het niet eens over, daar moet je niet eens over praten, Astrid.
Nou, zo'n beetje in die richting. Ze zullen het wel gevoeld hebben, denk ik.
Nou.
Ik denk van wel.
En daarbij komt nog, en dat is heel belangrijk.
Nou.
Dat als je thuis bent gebleven, dan is er aan het programma eigenlijk niets aan. Dan is het maar heel saai en vervelend om te horen. Misschien vind je de muziek leuk. Wel nu, de muziek werd verzorgd door Astrid, die hier naast me zit.
Nee, jouw broer, Joop de Ridder.
En mijn broer, Johannes de Ridder. De stemmen in het programma waren van Astrid Antonsiek.
En Willem de Ridder.
En niet te vergeten Hans C. Klaassen.
Ja, die C, daar staat hij op, hè.
Ja, ja. En...
Zeg, wat denk je van nog even een stukje muziek erin?
Ik geloof
dat... We maken
dat...
het zo saai, hè, voor ja. De mensen thuis. Het is ook wel de bedoeling, natuurlijk.
Mm-hmm.
Nog een opbeurend woord voor de mensen in Woudrichem die aan het eind van het pad staan.
Alle automobilisten die nog onderweg zijn. En maak een beetje voort. Maar tegelijkertijd rij voorzichtig. Als je tot nu toe... de instructies niet heb kunnen volgen, dan is het te laat. Want we zullen ze niet meer herhalen. Hilversum 3, wordt nu weer doodgewoon Hilversum 3.
Hebba.
Gewoon met moderne popmuziek.
Zoals gewoonlijk.
Zoals gewoonlijk.
Altijd hetzelfde.
Zit je klaar voor een lekker plaatje thuis? Na 6 uur verandert bijna elke stad in Nederland in een spookachtige stad. Leeg en griezelig. Een typische omgeving waar moorden kunnen plaatsvinden. De angst zal dan ook stijgen. Alle geest, alle spirit is uit Nederland verdreven. Amsterdam was nog het laatste overgebleven terrein waar nog een beetje te leven viel. De lastige Amsterdammers hebben het uitgehouden tot nu toe. Maar de druk is te groot geweest. De geest is verdwenen. Amsterdam is dood. Er is in Nederland niets meer te vinden. Niet hebt kunnen meedoen, of niet hebt durven meedoen, of niet hebt willen meedoen, nog een gezellig plaatje. Hilversum 3 raast door.
You know, when first jotting down some notes as to what I wanted to talk about today, I thought it was going to be one of those magazine episodes with just a bunch of different pieces and no real theme. But when I look at them, I think, in a way, they're all, to some degree, about end games. Hello, I'm Mark Galliotti, and welcome to my view of Russia in Moscow shadows. This podcast, of varying length, frequency and format, yet always reassuringly low production values, is supported by generous and perspicacious patrons like you, and also by the crisis exercise software company Conductor. Before I start, you may well get the sound of occasional seagulls or other background noises, but, well, tough luck. It's early enough in the morning amidst this bestial heatwave that Europe has been having that there's no way that I'm not going to have the windows wide open as possible to get all the breeze I can. And, well, in fact, again, following a certain theme. I mean, thanks to the organisers who invited me to speak last week at the Bundeswehr Centre for Military History and Social Sciences in Potsdam, and indeed also to the audience who braved those ridiculous temperatures to come and hear me speak. And apparently, I think a recording of that event is going to be released in due course. I'll let people know when that happens. And also thanks to Gwendolyn Zasa and Zeus, the Centre for East European and International Studies in Berlin, for the invitation to come and speak on the power of the Russian intelligence services. And speaking of spooks and power, the first topic I wanted to address was the death the other day of Sergei Ivanov, another 73-year-old. And, well, patrons will have already received my sort of first thoughts, retrospective on his career. And the aspect that I wanted to talk about is really how it demonstrates, first of all, how much of power in Putin's system depends on his personal likes and dislikes, and often the sort of complex emotions he has towards people. But secondly, also the alternative perspectives, the alternative trajectories, rather, that Russia could have taken. So let's start with likes and dislikes. For those who don't particularly know him, I mean, and he hasn't been in frontline politics for quite some time, after all, Sergei Ivanov was in many ways the kind of Soviet and spy that Putin himself always aspired to be. He was urbane, he was fluent in English and Swedish. He pretty much immediately got into the first chief directorate, which was the KGB's relatively elite foreign intelligence arm, three overseas assignments and such like. But the interesting thing was also that actually his career track in the early stages, or his background, very much actually mirrored Putin's. You know, they're at the same sort of age, roughly. They both came from Leningrad. They both came from relatively impoverished backgrounds. I mean, actually, Ivanov's was even worse. His father had died, brought up by a single mother. They both went to Leningrad State University. Putin read law, which was frankly the kind of thing which tends to anyway push you towards the domestic security side of things, even though that wasn't necessarily what Putin wanted. Ivanov, on the other hand, was a linguist. So, very great similarities, but on the other hand, Ivanov was a rather different person. You know, he actually, and indeed, he spent time abroad not just in the context of intelligence operations under diplomatic cover. He also spent a year doing English language training at Ealing College in London as part of his degree. Again, this is always one of the weird things about Putin. This is a man who essentially never had any contact or real interest in the world outside the Soviet borders. I mean, even East Germany, which he did actually travel around when he was attached to KGB office in Dresden. But nonetheless, again, that was after the event and it was in a more of a professional capacity. This is not a person who has travelled in the West at all, except precisely once he was in power and once he was part of official delegations. So no apparent curiosity about the world. And so for Putin, and again, here it's the crassest of sort of long-distance amateur psychoanalysis. My view has always been that he saw Ivanov with a mix of respect and envy, that this was the guy who in some ways had the life he had. But nonetheless, it was a very kind of close relationship, and one that I'm sure Putin relished, that he was generally going to be the boss, that he would... Ivanov was poached by Putin from the SVR to come to the FSB when he was head of the FSB, becoming his deputy. Likewise, he would then become Secretary of the Security Council after Putin, when Putin became Prime Minister. Once Putin was president, he brought Ivanov in as his defense minister. Later on, also as Deputy Prime Minister, he would become head of the presidential administration. So, you know, there's always that sense of tracking, but never the chance of Ivanov replacing him. Though, again, this is where the whole maybe man factor comes in. There was this interesting issue in 2007 when there's different possible scenarios being discussed behind closed doors in the Kremlin above all, well, also in the presidential administration, about what to do, because Putin's coming up to the end of his second presidential term in office, and term laws mean that he cannot stand for a third. So there's some who are saying, we'll just change the constitution to take out that particular requirement. But on the other hand, there's also the option that is being taken, that it ends up being taken, which is that he picks a suitable kind of proxy president to serve a term, while he himself goes into the position of the prime minister, albeit a prime minister plus, shall we say, with enhanced powers. And that gives him the option of either then returning after this period of castling, as it's known, or else actually, and I think this was really being considered, certainly by Putin, that he could actually leave politics altogether if he felt that things were in good hands. So the question is, who is going to be that proxy president? And the two real contenders were Dmitry Medvedev and Sergei Ivanov. Now, Ivanov was better known and more popular than Medvedev, something attested to by both opinion polls, but also the opinion of his peers. And in some ways, that may well have been precisely the problem. As it was, there was a sense maybe that Ivanov would do too good a job as stand-in president. And it's likely that his enemies were also whispering against him, foremost of which was Igor Sechin, who essentially also felt rather jealous of Ivanov. Remember, Sechin, also almost certainly an intelligence officer in the past, although probably military intelligence, GRU, rather than KGB, SVR. And was essentially whispering that, oh, well, Ivanov's people, they're already dividing up the ministries and they're already treating it like it's theirs. There may well have been a fear that Ivanov actually wouldn't have handed back the presidency at the end. So eventually went for Medvedev, who, was it a good choice or a bad choice? It was a good choice in the sense of this is ultimately a man who, although he did make a little bid to try and actually become a real boy, a real president, wearing a leather jacket, going to the Kuril Islands, posturing on security issues, which is merely meant to be Putin's field. Nonetheless, when it came down to it, he broke. And he rather pathetically actually endorsed Putin's return to the presidency, saying there was no better person for it. So it was a good choice if you're thinking just simply in terms of someone who just keeps the seat warm to allow Putin to return to the presidency. It's a bad choice if Putin had had any hope of getting off the power merry-go-round. Ultimately, I think that Putin himself found it impossible to consider himself to be at all dispensable. And more to the point, the people around Putin were very keen to convince him that he was indispensable, because after all, their positions, all the patronage that had been lavished upon them, depended upon Putin remaining in power. They feared that a new generation of cronies and favourites would take over without Putin, so they needed him to stay. But what might an Ivanov presidency have looked like? Obviously very hard to know, but I think there are some things we could say. I mean, first of all, look, he has at best a mixed record as a manager of a political system, in the sense that when he was defence minister, he basically got the problem. He realised that what Russia had at the time was a decaying husk, a remnant of the Soviet army. A system which frankly didn't work. A, it cost too much. But also, the whole basis of the Soviet military was really, it was built for one purpose, which is the absolute apocalyptic mass war. So however huge it was still really envisaged just as the skeleton on which mobilization of millions of reservists would then sort of build the full beast that would be unleashed. Now, that's fine if you are thinking about something more or less like a rerun of World War II, but it didn't really meet both the purse, but also the strategic requirements of Russia at the time. So he understood it. He tried to move a bit away from conscription and towards professionalizing the service. There was a greater number of units brought up to permanent readiness and so forth. But essentially, he was never willing or able to break the power of a conservative high command. And so you know, ultimately, his period is one of the foreshadowings, really, of effective military reform rather than really carrying it out. On the other hand, in his latter career, after he more or less resigned himself to the idea that he wasn't going to become, you know, president or prime minister, and he could indulge a very genuine passion of his for environmental issues and particularly things like saving the Siberian, well, the Far Eastern leopard, actually, he was surprisingly effective, whether it's in terms of pushing recycling, which, you know, was not really a Russian thing, but then has become much more of one, and also specific measures to do with wildlife reserves and so forth. The key things I think one would say that an Ivanov presidency would be is, first of all, you know, he wasn't a friend of the West, but on the other hand, as we saw with his interesting personal relationship with Condoleezza Rice, who was his sort of counterpart, they were both charged by Putin and George W. Bush with being the sort of point people for Russo-American relations. You know, actually, that was a very positive, friendly, I mean, respectful, even if, of course, you know, in some ways necessarily antagonistic relationship. So I don't think we would have seen a Russia that suddenly rushed towards liberal democracy. Oh, let's join the European Union and endorse, you know, European concepts of human rights and the like. But on the other hand, I also think that it would have been, you know, a much more, I think, efficient is the word that comes to mind, actual relationship. So less of the posturing, less of the outrageous language, probably a greater awareness of the inevitability of Russian decline. I mean, certainly Ivanov was a pragmatist. But also, I think it's fair to say that he would have listened much more carefully to technocrats, because he was himself, more than anything else, I would say, a technocrat, rather than a political or ideological figure. But in any case, he would not probably be president now. I mean, again, think of the trajectory. So you have 2008-12, let's say there's an Ivanov presidency. Now, in the real world, what happened is, within that term, very quickly, Medvedev put forward, clearly under pressure, the constitutional amendments that, first of all, extended term limits for a president from 4 to 6 years, and secondly, that did away with the term limits in question. Well, Ivanov might have not have done that. So what we might have had is that he serves out 2008-12, and then another four-year term, 2012 to, obviously, 2016, and then steps down. Now, that clearly covers the span of the Revolution of Dignity. Would Ivanov, in other circumstances, have taken Crimea? Possibly. Would he then have allowed himself to have been sucked into the wider conflict in the Donbass? And I say sucked into, I know it's controversial, my view is that the very initial impulse there came from a relative handful of locals who were not necessarily looking for independence from Ukraine, but just greater degree autonomy, or just pushing back against their concerns about the Revolution of Dignity, egged on and supported by ultranationalists within Russia, who included figures within the Kremlin, like Glazyev, but not with any kind of direct official backing, nor with any official blocking. I think Putin was just willing just to let see what happened, and only then later did he decide to throw his weight into it. Not in any way an excuse or whatever, but I think that it's, the timeline is significant. But anyway, I digress. So, you know, we might have had the annexation of Crimea and nothing more. Frankly, I think Russia would have got away with that, not because Kyiv would have been happy, but essentially some kind of de facto acceptance of that would, I think, have been possible. But anyway, regardless of that, one way or the other, he would have stepped down in 2016, and who knows who would have taken over. But it almost certainly, again, would have involved a generational shift down. So whoever would have become president, and I'm not even going to try and guess at that one, it would be someone who is not of the septuagenarian Homo Sovieticus generation. So this is why I think it's such a kind of an interesting, you know, what-if scenario. But of course, it didn't happen that way. So that's one kind of endgame, so certainly for Mr. Ivanov. The second issue I want to talk about, and only briefly because I do actually cover this in a piece in today's Sunday Times, and I don't just simply want to essentially read it out to you, is the current drone siege of Crimea, which, you know, is absolutely proving very effective, hammering first it was Crimean air defence installations, then using that opportunity to then strike at the various logistic connections, the roads, the railways, the ferry terminals and the bridges, clearly, that allow Crimea to be supplied, as well as things like power stations. You know, Sevastopol is periodically without energy these days. And no wonder that Sergei Aksionov, essentially the governor of the region, has declared a state of emergency. Now, the idea is that by striking at Crimea, which, you remember, is the crown jewel of Putin's various conquests, it's the one bit of Ukraine that most Russians actually do think is genuinely Russian. Well, that by striking at that, by raising the prospect, maybe that it could be retaken militarily, though that's probably not on the cards at the moment, but more to the point that just simply it becomes untenable to try and maintain your position in Crimea, that Putin is brought to the negotiating table. Is that possible? Well, look, I think Putin does indeed regard holding on to Crimea as somehow existential, politically, not just to his historic legacy, but also maybe his actual position. If he can't hold Crimea, then he does begin to look very, very weak indeed. So could this force him to come to terms? Maybe. Of course, it could also force him to escalate. And I think this is the factor that one needs to consider. And I should stress, this is not therefore me saying, well, that's why the Ukrainians shouldn't be doing this. I think it's just to say, this is why the whole process needs to be calibrated politically as well as militarily. Because remember, Putin still does have escalatory options. He could be pushed into a mobilization wave. There are people talking about that. There are people advocating it, knowing full well that it would be incredibly disruptive politically, but nonetheless saying, look, better to have a short, sharp shock. Do the things we need to do, however unpopular they are, in order to bring a quick end to this war, because exactly, we cannot allow this war to become a forever war. So mobilize reservists, maybe use conscripts as well, perhaps expand targeting even further, maybe even, you know, more covert attacks on the various connections, you know, whether it's the factories or the rail links or whatever, bringing weapons from Europe into Ukraine, you know, things like that, that maybe up to now people have held back precisely because of the different risks involved. But it's possible. I honestly don't know which is the way. The key thing, therefore, is, and this is one of the reasons why I have been so yammering on about the importance of maintaining contacts, not just for Ukraine, but for the West, with the Russians, is to actually have more in the way of connectivities through which messaging can be transferred to basically say, look, you know, this is what the situation is. This is the basis on which there is scope for negotiation. If Putin feels that there is no real scope for a negotiation that even allows him to save face, and I know a lot of people are saying, why should we let him save face? Well, the answer is, again, if you push a rat into a corner, that rat will turn on you. It may not make sense, but nonetheless, that is the rat's instinct. Putin knows that, having already faced such a rat in his childhood, again, going back to his own autobiography, and we don't necessarily want to make Putin into that situation. So I think that the importance here will be about finding political ways of also calibrating the campaign. You know, rather than, look, Zelensky's open letter to Putin during the St. Petersburg International Economic Forum was not an open invitation to negotiate. It was a direct and clear set of jibes precisely intended to provoke Putin into the kind of bloody-minded response which we got because Zelensky wanted to paint Putin as the troublemaker. Fair enough. But nonetheless, there is also a time for actually building some kind of route to conversation. But it also really, I think, highlights the degree to which, what is this war currently being fought for? I mean, you have a position in which the Russians are saying that it's all about Donbass, and then there are also these much more airy-fairy things about denazification of Ukraine, whatever that means, etc. But basically speaking, this is a war that is still being fought over that little bit of the Donbass, over whether or not there is a ceasefire and a negotiation after Russia takes it, as it still believes it can, or now without Russia having taken it, and Russia therefore having to accept that it's not going to get that territory. The Ukrainians are not going to just hand it over as part of any kind of a deal. I think it is an odd situation in which actually, if one really boils down where the key issue is here, it does seem to be that little bit of Donbass. Because the chance of the Russians being pushed out of most of the rest of the occupied territories, still not great, though again, one has to recognise that the Ukrainians have been pulling off surprises at the moment. But likewise, the chances of Russia actually being able to take that bit of the Donbass, I would say before winter, when I think probably the ground campaign will to a degree sort of block up, and instead the focus will be on both sides hammering the other's electrical grids, also not great. So maybe the Crimean siege is a way of trying to break that deadlock. And it may, but not necessarily in the way we'd like. But still, I do think it emphasises the extent to which we are coming towards an end game in the war. I know that sounds unduly optimistic at the moment, when both sides are so sort of dug in to their positions, both military and political. But just that is how it feels to me. Don't ask me to spell out how this thing comes to a kind of resolution. But just, and this is a deeply, deeply unprofessional way of putting it, and indeed a deeply unprofessional way of thinking about it, but just that is the vibe for me at the moment. But of course, endgames can be unpredictable, they can be risky. So let's talk a bit more about that after the break. Just the usual mid-episode reminder that you're listening to the In Moscow Shadows podcast. Its corporate partner and sponsor is Conductor, which provides software for crisis exercises in hybrid warfare, counter-terrorism and civil affairs. But you can also support the podcast yourself by going to patreon.com/InMoscowShadows. And remember that patrons, as well as knowing that they're supporting this peerless source on all things Russian, get a variety of additional perks depending on their tier, including articles I've written, the most weekly Govorit Moskva press briefing, and other bonus content like the Chronicles of a Different Russia Alternative Histories. And you can also follow me on Twitter at Mark Galeotti or on Facebook, Mark Galeotti on Russia. Now, back to the episode. So, I did talk about the potential Putin might actually escalate over Crimea. And of course, one of the ways in which he could escalate is, this is the most extreme form, the use of a tactical nuclear weapon. Sorry, these are now called, for whatever reason, non-strategic nuclear weapons. And this has also become part of a wider debate. So first of all, I think it's worth noting a variety of reasons why I continue to be unconvinced that this is particularly likely. I mean, first of all, remember, these weapons, they have been mothballed for decades. They have not been tested out. They have not been overhauled since Soviet times. They're sitting in 12 arsenals scattered across the Russian Federation. And so, first of all, they would have to, or one or more, would have to be brought up to usable standards. And remember, there are no people currently within the Russian military who have any practical experience of doing that. So they'll be doing this off manuals, which can't be a very comfortable thing. Then, after that's been done, the actual warhead will have to be transported in, you know, a very visible, secure convoy with all sorts of specialist vehicles and so forth. Something that will be exceedingly visible to Western spy satellites, possibly to electronic intelligence, and also probably known about through human intelligence. But anyway, it will then have to be transported to wherever it will be mated to its delivery system, you know, a missile or whatever. So, in other words, we in the West should have advance notice, which not least gives us a chance to basically try and make, interventions to basically say, for God's sake, don't do this. And also hopefully give a sense of what will be the repercussions. And even more importantly, for the Chinese and the Indians, who have already made it very, very clear just how unhappy they would be with any breach of the nuclear taboo. They themselves, who probably would have rather better chances of influencing Putin. Anyway, then the question is, well, what would you use it for? Are you actually willing to go straight into firing a nuke, which could be shot down, so you might actually end up having to use multiple ones. But anyway, firing a nuke at a troop concentration? Well, at the moment, this is such a dispersed war that it would be a massive example of overkill. And maybe that's the point. Maybe you use it precisely as a political demonstration. You know, I'm willing to go to crazy lengths. You do not want to push me. Of course, a safer way of trying to demonstrate that is to, as some have suggested, demonstratively firing one into the sea. The thing is, though, that is only really effective as a demonstration if there is a genuine belief that you would scale up to use against real targets, that you would hit Lviv or whatever with one, which, you know, again, it's a question whether or not people would really believe that Putin would be that insane, given all the various risks, and given the risk that it absolutely would galvanize the West. I mean, for a start, you can imagine every single Patriot interceptor that was intended for anywhere else would be being headed to Ukraine. And there will be that probably that sense that Putin had just become so dangerous, such a wild dog, that he needed to be put down. And in the circumstances, again, I find it hard to believe. And in many ways, I was reassured, despite the fact that it was surreal and disturbing, by a debate about the use of nuclear weapons that was raised in the context of a conversation between international relations scholars Sergei Karaganov and John Mearsheimer, mediated